Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order this meeting of the House Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And we do have a quorum. And the first order of business is to approve the minutes of February 20th. Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes of the 20th of February.
All right. Representative Bierman moves the minutes. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you very much. So, members, we're going to make a quick rearrangement of the agenda, if everybody's okay. We're going to move Representative Herr bills up, and that's because this is the one bill that needs to go to the floor, and I think it's probably not very controversial. And anyway, we're going to just try to do this real quick and move it out of the way, and then we'll get on to the rest of our agenda as set forth. So this is, let's see, House File 3387. So Representative Herr is going to move that House File 3387 be recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. And you know what, before I should have said a couple of things first. Sorry, I was going to say a couple things at the top of the meeting here just about the process for these scope and licensing bills, because this is the first one that we're taking up this session. And as most of you know, we generally put off scope and licensing bills to the second year of the biennium, which is what we've done. And we have a lot of them. The plan is, generally speaking, we're going to have a mini bus for scope and licensing. So most of the bills we hear are going to be laid over. A few have to make other committee stops, so we'll send them to their other committee stops, but we still could, as you all know, include them in a licensing bill, in a minibus. But this one is going to go to the floor and not, I mean, it could also be included, yeah, of course, in an omnibus, but there's some urgency on this one, which I think you'll hear about. So that's why we're doing the procedure. I also want to remind members and the public that we have these what we call questionnaires for people who have scope and licensing type bills, including compacts. You must have one of these filled out if you want your bill to get a hearing. There is a questionnaire A, there's a questionnaire B. Now there's also, sorry to say, a questionnaire C. C is for the compact bills. These are all posted. And, you know, just be attentive to that. If you have a bill that you think might fall in that category and you're not sure, be sure to talk to us. But otherwise, you know, the advocates should fill it out. Not usually the member, but just make sure that your advocates for your bills have got one of these things on file. And they're all posted, available to all members and the public. So with that, I'm sorry, Representative Herr, please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is actually really a non-controversial bill. It is a language clarification. Licensed traditional midwives have been licensed in Minnesota since 1999 and have been ordering and administering medication listed in their formulary in Statute 147D for over two decades. But over the past several months, multiple suppliers have stopped selling medication to licensed traditional midwives due to interpretation of the midwifery statute 147D.09. It's clear that licensed traditional midwives can administer the specific set of medications named in the statute, but the statute is not clear that licensed midwives are also authorized to purchase those medications. And so what we're doing is, just in this particular piece of statute, we're clarifying that they can also purchase in addition to administering. We are not changing what they can administer or what's in the formula. It's just saying they can purchase it now very explicitly as well. I had more that I could say about this, but I think it's pretty simple. And so I'm just going to have my testifier speak to this. She is a midwife, and she can talk to why the urgency of this situation, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. Please give us your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Rebecca Polston. I am a licensed midwife and the president of the Minnesota chapter of NACPM, which is the National Association of Certified Professional Midwives. I'm also the founder and owner of Roots Community Birth Center, which is a freestanding birth center located in North Minneapolis. Licensed midwives such as myself practice in home birth and birth center settings across Minnesota. We are the chosen providers for expectant families all over the state who have healthy, low-risk pregnancies and opt for out-of-hospital, or what we call community care. As Representative Herr stated, licensed midwives have lost our ability to purchase medication listed within our formulary. This issue started over a year ago, but has recently become more urgent as all of our suppliers have aligned on this interpretation. As you might imagine, the situation is very concerning for both midwives and the clients we serve. Many midwives are now relying on their current medication inventories, but those are limited. We are foreseeing significant disruptions to midwifery practices in the near future. Needless to say, this is distressing for both midwives as well as their clients, who may soon face the unwelcome choice of having to make a different plan with a different provider for their births. This bill would prevent unnecessary and harmful disruption to midwifery care across the state and allow midwives to continue their crucial maternal health care practices as they have for the past two decades. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And these licensed professional midwives are licensed under the Board of Medical Practice, right? And the Board of Medical Practice supports the bill, correct? Representative Herr?
That is correct.
Okay. All right. And that was Ms. Polston, just for the record, not Representative Herr. Okay. Very good. So is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify for or against the bill? Not seeing anyone. Are there questions, members? Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not so much a question as to thank you for the offering of midwifery. I have quite a few grandchildren, 20 actually. Not all of them were born with a midwife, but quite a few of them were born with midwifery. And I have to admit, I didn't like it. I was very concerned about it at first. And we've actually had some challenges with a few, but it has worked very well, and it works really well with the family. So I think it's a wonderful service for women to be able to deliver babies in a home setting most of the time, although you have a different setting there. So anyway, just wanted to make that comment because it wasn't on my radar. I thought they were nuts, but it's worked out fine. So,
all right, well, thank you, Representative Keel. Any other member questions, comments? All right, seeing none, so Representative Herr is going to renew her motion that House File 3387 be recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is going to the General Register. Thank you very much. All right. Now we will return to the way we set up the agenda originally and call up House File 2509, Representative Hewitt.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and good morning, members of
Good morning, Representative Hewitt. So the Chair is going to move that House File 2509 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Civil Law. And as I stated before, that would not preclude the fact that we could put it in our minibus if it gets its approval from Judiciary. And I understand there's an author's amendment, the A2, to put the bill in the form the author wants to discuss it. And is that correct, Representative Hewitt?
Madam Chair, that is correct. That's the amendment from the department, and it puts it in exactly the order that we want it in.
All right. So the Chair is going to move the A2 amendment to put the bill in the order in which the author would like to discuss it. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So to your bill as amended, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is definitely a bipartisan bill. I really applaud the members, those that are on this committee from both sides of the aisle that have signed on to this bill. This is a really good step to help our rural funeral homes and to help the workforce shortage that we're having. You'll hear that over and over today in my John Hewitt Day in Health Committee. But this is really to help the funeral industry with this. And also, it's twofold. When I was looking at leaving EMS, I actually started looking at the funeral establishment to maybe become a funeral director. The problem is that there's so many things that we don't know when you're looking at a career and you don't really have exposure. It's very limited in what the funeral home can actually let, like a night attendant, do. And so we were looking for ways maybe the last couple of years, how can we give people that are interested in the funeral industry a look at what the job details. And the removals are a big part of this. I actually participated myself in removals many times. It was probably not much different than being an EMT, to be honest with you. But this will give depth as far as staff to our funeral homes. And also, one of the problems we did have, when we did this during COVID, we let unlicensed people do it, and we had no problems. It worked out well. The department looked at this, and they sent their changes in their amendment. But realistically, we really thought that this is a needed thing. But what it did, it gave exposure, and it really, there's been a problem because of a short staffage around the state that people were having to wait to have their loved ones removed from place of death. And so this hopefully will, I don't know if this is the total answer, but this will definitely help. Today I have Ms. Thompson with me, a licensed funeral director, and I'd like to let her share her story with you.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please give us your name and go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. I'm Sarah Thompson. I'm a licensed mortician with Pat and Shad Funeral and Cremation Services. Today I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association, which represents more than 600 licensed funeral directors and over 250 licensed funeral establishments. We want to thank Representative Hewitt for his work on House File 2509. This language represents agreement among the different voices within our profession. Over the past few years, MFDA has worked with its members, non-members, those seeking to enter funeral service, and the Minnesota Department of Health on the issue of removals, specifically the prospect of removals by non-licensed morticians, a duty that current law requires be carried out by a licensed mortician. Using this feedback, MFDA has been working to achieve the goal of allowing those who are not licensed morticians to make removals while including important measures to require licensee supervision, Department of Health oversight, and appropriate training to protect the public health and the dignity of the deceased. House File 2509 accomplishes this goal. Primarily, it permits non-mortician, referred to as a transfer care specialist, to make removals from the place of death. It requires the individual to register with the Department of Health, which provides the department with oversight of the individual. It requires supervision by a licensed mortician, and it requires training. This training is an important piece to ensure the transfer care specialist knows proper removal procedure, potential health and safety concerns to the individual and the public, and the ethical care of a decedent. House File 2509 is years in the making, and we appreciate all of the stakeholders who've weighed in. It will provide a new option to carry out the duty of removals and will give new opportunities to those looking to enter the funeral profession. Again, we want to thank Representative Hewitt for leading on this issue, Chair Liebling, and you as a committee for your time and consideration. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Hewitt, are there any other testifiers that you have?
I was informed that we do have one more testifier, Mr. Archibald.
Oh, okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. My name is Robert Archibald. I'm a licensed mortician here in the state of Minnesota, and I've also founded an advocacy group for funeral service called the Funeral Service Roundtable. The Funeral Service Roundtable is in full support of this legislation, and there are a number of letters in your packet of support for members from the Funeral Service Roundtable. I want to thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone else, Representative Hewitt, does that conclude folks that you are aware of?
Madam Chair, yes. Short and sweet.
All right. Is there anyone in the room who wants to testify for or against the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone, so we'll open it up to discussion. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hewitt. I certainly support the bill. I'm just hoping that you can help me understand, and I apologize. I'm trying to work through the training requirements. I just want to understand this direct supervision piece from the amendment. It changed it so that for the purpose of transfer care specialist, direct supervision could be done via phone. I think that's the main change. Would they still be required to have direct supervision during a clinical practical internship period where they are learning more directly? Would they still have a period of time where direct supervision would fall under that category? Like I said, clinical practicum internship, just to ensure that there is still that piece of training where they would have more direct supervision and have somebody on site to help correct?
Okay, welcome to the committee, Mr. Selwood. Go ahead, introduce yourself.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Joe Selwood, representing the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association. On the direct supervision piece, the by telephone, the advise and correct as needed by telephone or physically present, that language only applies to the transfer care specialist. So the direct supervision is not impacted on a clinical practicum. That applies to interns who are gaining their license, if that makes sense.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as I look at the training program, at least 7 hours long, must cover ethical care and transportation procedures, health and safety concerns, et cetera, would that training program involve more direct supervision where someone was on hand to correct? And my point is, it seems like there should be at least some component where during that training that they have more direct supervision to ensure that as they're learning and in training that that's happening.
Mr. Selwood.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The training, in terms of our discussions with the department, because these are not licensed individuals, mm-hmm. and the training has to be completed prior to their registration with the department, that there actually is not oversight from the department. They don't have a regulatory reach into that individual's training prior to their registration with the department. So that's why there can't be direct supervision at that point. What there is going forward is that's in the amendment is required 3 continuing education credit hours to be submitted with each renewal, so that I guess wouldn't have the oversight of a mortician during that time, but it so the oversight applies to the duties, I guess, not the training.
Okay.
And I think they wanted to make it clear that this physically present or by telephone applies to the transfer care specialist, that the regular direct supervision is not changed in the oversight of the training of clinical practicum on intern students.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. as I read, I mean, it's not super clear what the training involves, ethical care and transportation procedures. I don't know if that would involve folks actually going into the field and performing these services. Certainly, it's perfectly, if you didn't have the phone option, this bill wouldn't even be necessary, really, because if you have to have a direct supervisor there all the time, then why have this bill? Because they can just do the job. So I totally get that. I totally see the need for it. But it seems like maybe it would be prudent to have some period of time, whatever that is, and maybe it's a number of cases that they work on, whatever, where there is some level of physical supervision to ensure that they're trained properly. It seems like, and I could be wrong, maybe the training does involve practical hands-on. I'm not getting that clearly from the language.
Yeah, I think there was a little confusion maybe between oversight being legal oversight from the department versus supervision by a licensed mortician. So anyway, Representative Hewitt, can you clear it up?
Yeah, real quick, Madam Chair, this goes along with many of our technical level training. I'm going to use my EMT example, right? I don't touch it. I wouldn't be allowed to touch a patient, do anything with a patient until I received my training. And then at that point, I had I can honestly say no funeral home in this state is going to let out a brand new employee to go do their own removal. They will do, and this gives our businesses their own, because they're going to want to do it in a certain way, how you deal with our families and stuff like that. I would say that they will be with them during this time. It just gives them the ability to let it go. And the supervision, I believe it's 4 for every one funeral director. And that funeral director is basically responsible to make sure they are doing it the right way. They could be at the scene, they could be on by phone, but it's four for one. I feel, as somebody that worked in the patient care space and had to have direct supervisors over me, I really feel comfortable with the language the way it is. And I'm glad we added the phone aspect, so it's very clear that you don't have to run out there, but call me by phone if there's a problem. And that's kind of where I think we went. I hope that puts some comfort to it, but I'm willing to work on it a little bit if you want some more work done, Representative Brindley.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hewitt. I appreciate that. I guess I would just want to make sure, because it is not clear in the language regarding what is required for the training, and it is certainly not clear in the direct supervision piece of the amendment that there is, and don't get me wrong, I mean, I understand, and I also have medical training, and certainly there is that direct oversight and that supervision. But it seems like, I mean, this is dealing with a really, it's a really important topic, and we want to be really respectful, obviously, of these remains in human bodies. And so it just seems like, and at one point or the other, whether it's in training or for some period of time after the training is completed, there should be some direct supervision, physical direct supervision, on-site direct supervision, because it seems like from the language there is no requirement where a person is being directly supervised on-site as a requirement at any point in this. Like, so somebody really could receive classroom training and be sent out. Now, I get that in practical terms that's not likely to happen, but we should write laws that cover our bases and not, you know, we should make sure that the language is clear on that. Thank you,
Madam
Chair. All
right. Well, thank you for that, Representative New Brindley. And this is why it's good that we're going to do a minibus. So it gives us time. So even though we're going to send the bill to judiciary because it has judiciary pieces in it, there's time to make some adjustments to it. And thank you for that. And, you know, Representative Hewitt, I think, will be, as he said, very open to that. So let's make these bills as good as we can make them. That's great. Any other discussion? All right. Seeing none, Representative Hewitt, should we go ahead? You don't need to make a closing? All right. Very good. That's it. Okay. So I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2509, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Civil Law. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is re-referred to Judiciary and Civil Law as amended. Okay. It is Hewitt Day in the committee. So the next bill on Representative Hewitt's agenda and ours is House File 1228, Veterinary Technicians. And so the motion here, I'm going to move that House File 12. Oh, did I take the wrong one? I got the right one? Okay. Just looking at this. I think I took it out of order. Yes, I'm sorry. I took it out of order. Is that okay, though?
No. You're in the right order.
I'm in the right order. Okay.
Yep. That's correct.
All right. There we go. It's too much here. Okay. So the motion there is going to be that House File 1228 be laid over for possible inclusion. So with that, Representative Hewitt, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. This is a bill that when they brought it to me, I was like, why would you want to restrict and do a license? I thought Megan Forbes would be in the room today, but she's not. That just tells me that she's okay with this at this point, I think. But this does put a licensing into the vet tech area. And when I went through and met with these great people and talked to veterinarians about this, and again, being in healthcare, and found out really what the vet tech's role is in a clinic, we need to license them. They basically fall under the scope of not even a nurse, but I would say a nurse anesthetist. They actually have control over many of the pharmaceuticals that are in the vet clinic. That to me, red flag right away, because I worked in ERs and stuff like that. The other thing is many of their practices that they do and what they actually get engaged in, really we need to keep an eye on this, and this is why we do licensing, right? And plus, they're pushing it. I was like, I've never had or never heard of an industry that came forward And actually, their colleagues, the veterinarians, are also here to talk about this. So I'm going to turn it over to them because their words are going to be the best ones to hopefully convince you. And again, this is going to have to do with workforce also, and we can talk about that later.
All right. So welcome to the committee. Go ahead and introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Kim Horn, and I want to thank Chair Liebling, Vice Chair Bierman, and committee members for your time today. I also want to thank Representative Hewitt for being chief author on this bill. I'm the Credentials Committee Chairperson for the Minnesota Association of Veterinary Technicians. Vet techs play a key role in public safety by being competent in the recognition and prevention of infectious and zoonotic diseases in our companion and farm animals, as well as in wildlife. We are involved with client education, dog bite injury prevention, and we dispense and administer medications, including controlled substances and opioids. Veterinarians also depend on vet techs who work in research facilities and governmental agencies to improve public health in areas such as disease prevention and food safety. This licensure bill aims to expand what a veterinary technician can do by creating a supervisory scope of practice. By allowing the veterinarian to supervise remotely and to delegate the responsibility of supervising non-licensed employees to the licensed vet tech will free up the veterinarian's time and more patients may be served. Licensure is not mandatory, so businesses can continue to operate as they are currently. But for those vet techs who choose to become licensed, they can be better utilized to increase efficiencies in our profession. We believe that fully utilized vet techs who have title protection are more likely to stay in the career field where Minnesotans can benefit from their education, skills, and knowledge. Licensure of vet techs will alleviate the critical shortages that we are experiencing in the veterinary industry, and regulation by the same board that oversees veterinarians will benefit public safety. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Thank you, members. Particular thank you to Representative Hewitt. My name is Al Bailey. I'm a practicing equine veterinarian and the chair of the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association's Veterinary Technician Committee. My first key point, the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association and the Minnesota Association of Veterinary Technicians have worked together to support this legislation with the intent of bringing Minnesota up to U.S. standards and reduce the shortage of veterinary technicians. As you've heard, we also have a shortage of veterinarians, particularly rural large animal veterinarians. Licensure of vet techs has the potential to reduce the impact of this shortage. In this bill is a provision for remote supervision of the veterinary technician by the veterinarian. My second point, there are over 2,600 voluntarily certified veterinary technicians in our association, the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association. As chair, I'm informed when complaints come to our association about veterinary technician misconduct, including theft of a pet owner's credit card and theft of controlled substances. Because their certification is voluntary, our association can't do anything. We believe that licensure of vet techs will provide state oversight as well as a mechanism of investigation through the Board of Veterinary Medicine with potential discipline for misconduct as well as access to the state's Health Professionals Service Program. My last point. Both associations are working together towards a licensure path for veterinary technicians. Therefore, we have proposed voluntary licensure with a lenient grandfather clause. We thank you for your time, and we ask for your support.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. I have one other person on the list, Julia Wilson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Julia Wilson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine and also a veterinarian. This group has spent a lot of time working with the board to get this bill and the conditions for licensing spot on. So the board fully supports the bill. There will be a fiscal impact, and in the interest of time, I'm happy to answer committee questions if you have any of those. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And with regard to fiscal impact, again, we'll be laying the bill over. We don't have a fiscal note yet on this, I don't think, but we will by the time the bill moves. So, all right. Well, thank you. Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify for or against the bill? All right. Not seeing anyone, so we'll open it up to questions from the committee. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you mentioned fiscal impact, there being fees, my understanding is you had the fees set so they would offset any fiscal impact. So this would be generally neutral to the state and to your organization.
Thank you, sir, for the question. That is correct after we get it established. So the main components of the fiscal note are rulemaking and database change and a half-time employee. So the initial two pieces will not be covered by fees that are generated because they won't be incoming yet.
Okay. And you know what? I was just pointed out to me that we actually do have a fiscal note for the bill. And Mr. Sandy is going to send that around to everyone. So we do have that. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doesn't the entity have a reserve fund that would cover this initial setup that then would be backfilled, so that I'm trying to see, are you basically taking a temporary funding from the state and then paying the state back, or are you planning to, we've got our reserves, we'll be spending this, we can cover that, and then when the fees come in, we'll be made whole?
Yeah, and I'm going to direct that question to our fiscal staff, Mr. Harney.
Chair Liebling, Representative Quam. So the way the state government special revenue fund works is that the boards need a direct appropriation from that fund in order to access the money. So while you may authorize revenues to be deposited, the board does not have the authority to spend unless there's an appropriation pursuant to a specific amount. So, and your example, yeah, you got it. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question for the testifiers. I just wanted to hear again, how many other states have this vet tech licensure right now? And in those states, are you seeing more veterinarians that are coming into the profession that you could attribute to this change?
Ms. Horn, do you want to address that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Bierman, we are about one of eight or nine states that currently do not have any regulation. It's because each law is different. Some states have title protection. There's no apples to apples comparison, but we do believe that this is helping keep individuals in the profession longer because they are better utilized and have title protection, which our surveys have shown is very important to veterinary technicians.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that answer. I wanted to say thank you for coming and briefing me on the bill at great depth. And I think it's a really good bill, and thank Representative Hewitt for bringing forward. From what I see, it builds competency in the profession and it continues education. And one of the critical parts I really like is that veterinary assistants can remain veterinary assistants, and that gives clinics a lot of flexibility. So appreciate your work. And maybe last question, just if Rep. Hewitt could spell veterinarian for me. No, no, I think I'll withdraw that question. All right, thank you.
And, you know, thank you for that, Representative Bierman. I was also going to ask about that very same thing because it wasn't really spelled out in anybody's testimony about kind of We've used the term title protection, but as I understand the bill, so the people who are currently practicing as veterinary assistants or technicians who don't care to become or aren't qualified to become licensees can continue as veterinary assistants, but under more supervision by the veterinarian or now by the newly licensed technician. Maybe somebody could just kind of spell that out real clearly for us, Ms. Horn, are you the one that can do that?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. That is correct. Anybody that is currently working in a practice as a veterinary assistant or a non-certified veterinary technician can remain in their current role with all the same duties. They will just now refer to themselves as a veterinary assistant. What we are adding for those technicians that choose to become licensed is they will now have the ability to supervise a task that was delegated by the veterinarian to the veterinary assistant, and they can be that individual that is in visual or audible range of that work being performed.
Okay, thank you. Representative Murphy and then Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a supporter of this bill. I spent most of my life working with animals in terms of a dairy supply business, and I can just tell you how in trouble we are with large animal veterinarians. And so this really becomes the eyes, ears, and hands of the veterinarians to get that extra support we need at the farms. But it's a really serious situation. I've talked with people just recently, and the number of veterinarians that I knew 25 years ago and the number that are today are drastically different. So this is just a really good bill at making sure we can get those services out, and I just think it was well thought through. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one really quick question, I think, for the doctor that was in charge of the task force. Did I normally don't like licensure. I love certification. I love registration. I love that you guys work together, and Representative Hewitt, thank you for bringing this bill. My question is, did you look at the, and you might have to speculate, but did you address the possible cost increases on the consumer with licensure and with the number of people that are moving over from, you know, a tech status to a license status, what the anticipated cost increases could be? I mean, I know that it's going to vary from business to business, but just did you look at that as a component of your study?
Dr. Bailey?
Yeah, thanks, Chair Liebling. Thank you, Representative. We did. And actually what we see and anticipate is that some of the costs may go down because of improved efficiencies, particularly as has just been addressed. I'm a large animal veterinarian. If I've got and I predominantly do horses, if I see a horse that requires, we get a tick-borne disease here in Minnesota, and that requires IV administration of antibiotics for 5 to 7 days, once I've made the diagnosis, if I had the right technician working for me, there's no reason that individual couldn't go out and do potentially the follow-up treatments for me. I always go back 2 weeks later and pull a complete blood count on that patient. My veterinary technician could do that. That's going to be a cost benefit to the consumer. It's going to be more efficient for practices. Did I answer your question, sir?
Madam Chair?
Yeah, Representative. Sir, I can't see you over there. So.
Representative Schumacher's in the way.
You just have to wave here.
And thank you. No, that answers it. I mean, I think that's fantastic. Hopefully, I don't have a horse. I have a dog, and I love my vet, and my prices keep going up. So I'm looking forward to that price reduction. So thank you.
Now the world knows.
Get a horse.
Okay, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill. I just want to reemphasize and highlight the impact that it will have on handling of controlled substances. That is a huge thing for me. So the fact that we have a process for misconduct and those people who are engaging in those types of things, that can be tracked, and then we can avoid them from taking care of other animals and continuing their misconduct. So thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, seeing no further discussion, I think Representative Hewitt's going to say it's a good bill. Vote for it.
I was getting all excited. You stole my head. But I do want to, the other thing I need everybody to understand on this committee, we're preventing a problem that has not happened. There has not been any record, there has not been any cases of diversion in this industry. I know in my industry, in healthcare, there has. But here we're trying to get to it before it happens. So thank you, Representative, for that comment. And, yes, this is a great bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Actually, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion. So House File 1228 is laid over for possible inclusion. Okay, House File 1817. And so I will move that House File 1817 be laid over for possible inclusion. And for this one, there is a DE1 amendment, and let me just get that out here. And so that is, I think, the author's DE1 amendment. Am I right?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right. So the chair will move adoption of the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the shape in which the author would like to have it discussed. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. So, Representative Hewitt, to your bill as amended.
Madam Chair and members, thanks again. Veterinarians, rock. I never had anything to do with vets other than pay a bill, so this has been interesting to get all these bills. I worked on a farm for a while. Anyways, this bill is actually pretty interesting of what we want to go, because it's exclusive to the University of Minnesota. And what it does is it expands their field to look for vets that just work at the U. And this is great because we can bring in ideas from all over the world. And so I'm going to let Dr. Hansen explain a little bit more about this. But when I heard this bill the first time, I thought this is a great bill for us to look at so we can expand the horizons and expand what we can do at the U and get input from everywhere.
All right. Thank you. Dr. Hansen, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Mike Hansen. I'm a veterinarian, and I've been at the university for over 30 years. I'm sitting in today for Dean Laura Mulgard, who happens to be in Arizona. So thank you for your time. So as we've heard already from the previous bill, there's a shortage of veterinary technicians. There's a shortage of veterinarians in our state and across the nation. And there's also a shortage of veterinary faculty to train that next generation in order to continue to serve the people of the state. And so currently, Minnesota, because of the statute as it's written, we are at a disadvantage compared to other states. And so we can only hire graduates from American Veterinary Medical Association accredited colleges of veterinary medicine or specialists that have already achieved board certification. And you may not know this, but after residency training, it may take up to a year for them to take boards before they're considered board certified. So we can't hire those individuals even if they wanted to come to Minnesota based on the current statute. Other states allow their veterinary colleges to hire, recruit the best and brightest from all over the world. And so we just want to sort of level the playing field with other states like Michigan and North Carolina and Missouri and who have a way for them to hire these individuals that are highly trained. So what we're asking for is to create an institutional license for the University of Minnesota that will allow these highly qualified faculty, residents, and interns to practice and teach in the university. And all the other licensure rules still apply. And the license is revoked if they leave the university. So this isn't a backdoor to get a Minnesota license. This is a way for us to expand the pool of candidates for us to have as faculty. And so the risks if we don't do this is, one, we currently have a faculty deficit, which is making it difficult for us to train residents and the next generation. And it's projected that we're going to have not only increased class sizes, but new veterinary schools that are proposed to be opened. 12 new veterinary schools are proposed to be opened. And so the faculty, the need for more faculty members is going to go up tremendously in the next few years. And so not only will we have fewer veterinary specialists to train the next generation, putting our education in jeopardy, there's also going to be a smaller pool of residents and interns. And that's particularly true for large animal. We're having trouble recruiting residents, and so we really want to be able to recruit these individuals that are interested in that field. And this bill could potentially improve the diversity of our faculty. And very importantly, we're a big ag state, so our swine and dairy and poultry industries rely on our veterinary diagnostic lab for disease surveillance and for diagnosis purposes. And we're having trouble hiring pathologists. And so this change will allow us to be able to increase that pool. So I hope you support this bill.
Thank you. And I just want to point out to members, so Dr. Hansen does have a PowerPoint, which you have a copy of in your packet. I think we were unable to get that projected today. It is also online for the public. And so I don't know if, Dr. Hansen, do you have a copy of that in front of you? Is there anything more you want to say It's just a short presentation, and I think it kind of goes through what Dr. Henson was just talking about. So, Dr. Henson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I heard that I needed to keep it to 2 minutes, so I cut out sort of the background part, but it had been covered before that there's a deficiency of veterinarians and veterinary technicians, so that's I was just building the case.
Perfect. So, thank you very much. I also have Dr. Wilson on the list for this one. Welcome back. And you need to go ahead and state your name again, just like you weren't here before.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Julia Wilson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine. This initial bill had some little tweaks that the board wanted and met with the Veterinary College. The Veterinary College has been very accommodating. The board met yesterday with Dr. Henson as well as the diagnostic lab faculty, and the board is now very comfortable with the current version of the bill. There will be no fiscal impact to the board, and so the board encourages you to pass the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Wilson. I meant to say to you before, I think it's very helpful to have the board's involvement, so appreciate that. And especially, I think, even though we have jurisdiction over these veterinary bills, this isn't something that we're accustomed to. And it's interesting to hear that some members have more familiarity than others, but obviously it's very important, and actually, as has been mentioned, very important for human health as well. So. All right, so is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify for or against the bill? Okay, not seeing any other testifiers, so we'll move to member questions. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I grew up on a hog, expanded hog operation that my brothers had through FFA, and I can tell you that it is very necessary to have the veterinarian, and very difficult, especially up in northern Minnesota where we have fewer animals. So it's really important. And I'm always excited when I can see a student that's interested in being a veterinarian starting in Crookston's university campus and then able to fast track. We have that program mm-hmm. that sends our students to the cities eventually because that's where they have to go to get their doctorate. But it is just super important for us as animal safety, and the more you can handle animal health early, the better the herd is. If you can catch things at a very quick stage, we've heard about bird flu, but we've had hog diseases, and even my brothers will tell me that you have to manage the air quality in the barn. A lot of people think, oh, they're all tied up in a barn, but actually they're much better off in that where they can handle the bugs and the, when I grew up, we showered the hogs in the very heat of the summer because you were trying to get the flies off as well as cool them down because pigs don't cool down well. They only have their snout to cool themselves down in. So I know very little about it, just enough to be dangerous. I know how to herd the animals if I have to, but they don't call me anymore. So anyway, this is important. It is really for our animals, and I really appreciate all that you're doing, and thanks, Representative Hewitt, for carrying it. It's quite an eye-opener to see all that has to happen. So. And my sister-in-law wouldn't like me bragging on her, but she's a really good veterinarian tech. She's learned all of her abilities through the veterinarian that comes to their place. So she can handle things by phone, and she doesn't do as much of that anymore. But thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Representative Keel. Representative Doe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, I'm curious, Dr. Henson, why... If other states can recruit people from around the world, why is Minnesota limited to only AVMA-accredited schools?
Dr. Henson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So a good question, and if you go 10, 15 years ago, they all had that language. It was an easy way to sort of set a minimum bar that if they're from an American Veterinary Medical Association accredited school, that it's a good school. And so that was just an easy measuring tool. But other states have recognized that we have this problem with it in recruiting top faculty. And so they made that change earlier than we have. And so I think if you think about, you know, England, they have accreditation programs for their schools as well. It's just not the American Veterinary Medical Association. It's the English one or the Czech one or whatever. And so they have their own accreditation. And it was just an easy bar for us. And it is hard for instance, the Board of Vet Med to be able to certify that the Czech School of Veterinary Medicine is of adequate quality. And I think the important thing here is that we're recruiting the people who are their best and brightest, the ones who are able to get into very highly competitive residency programs and then make it through their residency and eventually potentially get the board certification. And we're trying to address that gap because there's this, you know, a good time period before they actually can take their boards. And they run away. They go elsewhere before we have a chance to recruit them. So it was mostly just the old rules were the reason for convenience.
And Representative Dindell.
And just to follow up then, so thank you for that. So, and if that's the case, and I want to thank Dr. Wilson. She talked with me last night, and I thank her for this. And we talked a little bit about if a vet who now got an institutional license at the U of M, and I asked her about, you know, once they, if they stop, they leave the university employment, then they'd lose their licensure. And I see that is in here, their license get canceled. And why are we doing that? If we're getting the best and the brightest, I want them to stay here. And they don't necessarily have to stay at the U, but why would we cancel their license if, you know, I know it's circumventing this AVMA that a lot of other states have gotten rid of, but why would we cancel, why would we limit them to only practicing at the U of M? Why would we want to do that?
So I'm going to ask Dr. Hansen to answer, but Representative Nadeau, it's so interesting that you're asking that because I asked very similar questions when they were in my office too, so we're all thinking the same way. Dr. Hansen.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you for the question. The pool of individuals that we'd be recruiting for these faculty positions, there's only one veterinary school in the state. And so if they're going to be moving on to another faculty position, they would be moving to another state anyway. And so the question if they would choose to step out of the faculty role and into a specialty practice role, we were hoping to get this passed so that we can at least take care of our issue as educators in the state. It is our primary goal is to meet the needs to train the next generation, and so that's the reason why we made this request this way, because it affects us specifically. But I can see that individuals might have an incentive to stay at the University of Dallas, if you put it that way. That wasn't our purpose in doing it. It's mostly to increase our recruitment.
So I think maybe Dr. Wilson would be the person who could probably address kind of your question, Representative Nadeau, because I think it's more about, you know, why can't this person get a regular Minnesota license, right? Why are we locking out those people? So, Dr. Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are a couple of other components that I believe are important. The Board of Veterinary Medicine's purpose is to protect the public, and part of that is making sure that the veterinarians that are available to the public meet a standard of education and competency. So in addition to what Dr. Henson has mentioned, there's also a national exam that everybody is expected to pass, but these foreign graduates are not eligible, and that's not our rule. Right. It's you know, pretty much countrywide except for these institutional licenses. So that is one barrier. They aren't eligible for that national exam. And the second part is, yes, there are pathways they could follow to be able to work with a regular license outside the university. But as we discussed yesterday, these programs are across species. They take over a year. They're thousands of dollars, and the individual has to spend a full year going through the clinical rotations at a veterinary college that is accredited before they can take a competency examination for all species, and then they're eligible for licensure. We need more solutions, and maybe you've got some great ideas you could share, because it is a national and international issue. So thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Other questions? All right. Not seeing any. Thank you. So with that, I'm seeing no other discussion. House File 1817 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. As amended. Okay. More Hewitt bills. House File 2111. And so I will again move that House File 2111 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus. And okay. Representative Hewitt, back to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and again, thank you, members. This is truly my last bill. You'll see
for
me
this
later.
Session.
This session. Yeah, not this session. Please, Chair, no. this bill is actually a really good bill. It has to do with our dental assistants. We saw a glitch in our bill, actually, in our statute that basically really specifically said who and what accreditations they have to have to apply to be a dental assistant. We want to broaden that. Again, this is workforce. We need to broaden this, especially for workforce in rural Minnesota. So with me today is Dr. Perpich, a familiar dentist name in this state. She's going to bring some light to why we need this.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. I have to ask, any relation?
No close relation, no.
No. Okay. Okay. I'm not sure whether that helps or hurts in this room. But welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Rose Perpich, and I am the president of the Minnesota Dental Association and a practicing dentist in Stillwater, Minnesota. I graduated from the University of Minnesota in 1997 and have been practicing private family practice ever since. On behalf of our organization, I thank you for providing me with an opportunity to testify on House File 2111. Like most communities across the country, Minnesota faces a dental assistant shortage. Dental practices have found it really difficult to hire and fill open dental assisting positions. Many practices have had vacancies for over a year, particularly in our rural communities. One of the many reasons for this shortage is that Minnesota currently has barriers to licensure for out-of-state applicants. Some qualified dental assistants willing to find meaningful employment in Minnesota cannot do so without a substantial burden. In return, some dental clinics are unable to provide the care necessary due to cutting doctor hours or number of patients that they're able to see, as they're not able to find assistance. Excuse me. Currently, a dental assistant in seeking licensure by credentials is required to have graduated from a dental assisting program that is accredited by the Commission on Dental Accreditation, or CODA, and be certified by the Dental Assisting National Board, DANBY. Other states, such as Wisconsin, Iowa, and the Dakotas, do not have this requirement. For example, Iowa requires that a dental assistant graduate from a CODA accredited program, but they don't have to pass the DANBY, or South Dakota, they can require one or the other. So essentially here in Minnesota, we are wanting to change the word. So if a dental assistant moving here from another state can either go to a CODA accredited program or take the DANBY or National Board to apply for licensure here, they still have to take the Minnesota Dental Assisting Licensure Exam to be credentialed here in Minnesota. But I've personally interviewed many people over the years, especially since I am in Stillwater, so a lot of people come over from Wisconsin, and I've learned that the first question I ask is, have you already got your license in Minnesota? And they'll say, oh, not yet, and I'd say, okay, well, then you need to call me when you do. So House File 2111 changes the application criteria to allow dental assistants to have either the COTA accredited program or the national board exam. This doesn't mean they don't go to a dental assisting school. It just means that the school they may have gone to is not necessarily COTA accredited. They're still taking the state license. The bill does not change a dental assistant's scope of practice. It simply expands the applicant pool to provide more candidates with this that may be qualified for licensure. It's important to note that applicants still need to demonstrate their non-COTA accredited program is comparable to the curriculum of a COTA accredited program. Applicants also need to meet at all other application criteria for the board, and the bill does not lower the standard of dental assistants in Minnesota. While the bill will not solve Minnesota's dental assistant workforce issues, it is a step in the right direction that the legislature can take to improve our workforce current situation. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I urge you to support this bill. Thank you to Representative Hewitt for bringing this bill forward, and thank you, Chair Liebling, for hearing this important piece of legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify for or against the bill? Not seeing anyone. So we'll go to discussion. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This would be effective the day after being signed into law.
Representative Hewitt.
I'm phoning a friend right now, Madam Chair.
Let's go to Ms. Sunderman, our analyst. Ms. Sunderman.
Oh, okay.
Chair and members, this would be effective, assuming it is in a policy-only bill, it would be effective on the default effective date, which would be August 1st of 2024. If it involves, if it's part of a finance bill, then this would be effective July 1st, 2024.
All right. Representative Kwan?
Madam Chair. This is being laid over for inclusion. This looks like a technical bill, and I thought there were special designation for a technical bill that changes less than 10 characters in statute. In other words, you're getting rid of three characters and replacing it with two. And we've got the shortage of, you know, staffing, et cetera. I would hope that we could do some minor change like this without waiting and waiting and waiting. I just thought that, you know, we could have this move by itself or with a couple of other very small technical type changes like we've seen some of the other bills and get that done and effective more quickly than waiting for months and months and months, because, you know, frankly, we need to have the staffing. And if we have graduation from schools happening, a couple of those before this becomes effective, they can't come to Minnesota because they call, are you licensed in Minnesota? No, well, not yet. Then they're going to go to a different state. And so change is fairly minimal, but the unintended delay or those effects of the delay, I think, could cost us the, you know, influx of people to the state to fill these jobs that we're missing. And this being a health committee, I did not see the disclaimer for reaching the limit of Hewitt bills within one session. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Well, Representative Crum, I mean, I don't view this as technical, frankly. This is not. We've just heard that it's changing, you know, even though the bill itself is very simple, changing an and to an or is a pretty significant change. And as far as waiting months and months and months, we don't have that in our session. This is going to be a really quick session. So, you know, I think having this become effective July 1st or August 1st, I mean, I think anyone who's bringing us one of these bills probably feels that it's, you know, should have been done yesterday, but this is our process and we're stuck with it. So any other discussion? All right, seeing none, House File 2111 is...
Madam Chair?
Oh, yes.
I just want you to know that I really appreciate you bringing this, and you take your time, and any time you need me here, I will be here.
Well, thanks, Representative Hewitt. You could come back and join our committee. I mean, we've missed you this term, so... hopefully we'll see you back again soon. So, thank you. So, with that, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion. All right. We're done with Hewitt for now. We're done beating up on Hewitt. Okay, Representative Bonner. Oh, I'm sorry. Agbaje. That's because we took one out of order. I'm a little confused here. Okay, welcome to the committee, Representative Agbaje. You see how mean we are to our visiting members who are presenting bills. So this is House File 2743, and because Representative Agbaje is not on the committee, the chair will move that House File 2743 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus, and there is an author's amendment, the A1. Representative Agbaje, is that correct? Is that your amendment? It looks like it just changes dates.
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. So chair will move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the form the author would like. All in favor of adoption of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So, Representative Agbaje, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here today to present House File 2743, a bill to support a state licensing program for art therapists in Minnesota. Art therapy is a distinct and independent mental health profession, and art therapists, like other mental health professionals, are like other mental health professionals, but they do not yet have the equivalent recognition at the state level. Currently, art therapists rely on licensure through related allied mental health professions, but the window for that option is closing rapidly. That's partly due to an increased interest in cross-state licensing in the mental health field, particularly clinical counseling, which would now seem to focus solely on the clinical counseling requirements. Art therapists are trained in trauma-informed and developmentally appropriate nonverbal approaches to therapy unique to their field. Art therapists must show competency in the use of art materials and understanding how the specific properties of different art materials and the active art-making process elicit changes in neurobiology. Without this specialized training, the potential for harm caused by inappropriate uses of art in therapy is high. So such a licensing program would also protect the public from people who are not therapists and purport themselves to be art therapy practitioners. These practitioners, unlike art therapists, are not academically trained and do not have clinical skills required for safe, effective, and ethical practice of art therapy. An art therapy state licensing structure would benefit people seeking art therapy and clinics seeking to offer art therapy with greater access and potential affordability. Without a state license program, art therapists are not recognized by insurance companies or employers as licensed mental health professionals, unless that therapist has an additional license in another field like clinical counseling, social work, or marriage and family therapy. Without an opportunity for insurance reimbursement, many families who need access to this important mental health care are priced out of that opportunity. A licensing structure for art therapists would not prevent other types of therapists from using art in their work, but for clients seeking art therapy specifically, a licensing program would ensure that they are engaging with licensed professionals specially trained in this mental health field. And with that, I'll turn to my testifiers.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Agbaje. So welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Hello. My name is Brianna Colton. I am a registered art therapist, a licensed professional clinical counselor here in Minnesota. I currently work in private practice in the North Metro. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee, for the opportunity to speak. And thank you, Representative Agbaje. Art therapy, as was stated, is an independent mental health field. We are trained as art therapists in art making, the ways art making changes neurobiology. We are trained in the ways to use art materials, the ethical use of art materials in our sessions. Other mental health fields do not have that opportunity to learn those things. And we are trained, And it does not mean that we have ownership over art. That is one of the biggest things that is brought to us, is that, well, who can say that we can, that who can use art in a session? It's more about the training, it's more about the ethical use of the material, and the fact that art making does change neurobiology. It changes the ways that people process memory. It changes the way people, their affect, their mood, their emotional regulation. I have worked with kids on the spectrum, the autism spectrum, and I have seen how art making has changed their ability to self-express, which we know is a really difficult thing for kids on the spectrum. It has improved social engagement. It has improved their ability to regulate their emotions. And that is because of the nonverbal properties. I have also worked with women, kind of mostly adult women, in sexual assault experiences. And they have said to me that using art to process it, using that nonverbal tool, has allowed them to move through that experience in a way that they could not do in talk therapy, that they had tried to do it through talk therapy before and were unsuccessful. And because of my training as an art therapist, I had the tools to know when, to know how, and to know in what ways to use materials to, or to not, to use containment, to offer kind of, to know how far to push and how far to hold back, and that is just a specific training that we have as art therapists. As a mental health professional and as an art therapist, I have to have both licenses currently, which means I have to pay two fees. I pay for an art therapy credential through a national credentialing board to practice as a registered art therapist. I also have to pay a state licensing fee for my clinical counseling license, and that is what I have to do in order to practice. The state, creating a state art therapy license would eliminate the double, would allow us to have just one way of practicing that would be recognized, and it would allow insurances to reimburse. It would allow greater access. Creative arts therapies programs are being expanded in employer in different settings. At the VA, in Department of Corrections, in schools, in a whole host of different places, creative arts therapies is growing in interest. But because there isn't this reimbursable ability to have those services paid for, it's just not done. And there's not as many credentialed people to do it. We do have a master's program here in the state. There are about 35 programs nationally. We have one here in Minnetonka at the Adler Graduate School. So having a state license incentivizes students to stay once they graduate, which would again expand opportunities and access to mental health services. As we know, we're going through a mental health crisis in our country, and so this just, it's a win all the way around.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to please wrap it up, because we're kind of running out of time here in the hearing.
My colleague will talk to the piece of harm. There is a risk of harm associated with not having a license.
All right.
With that, I will pass.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. I'm going to ask you to be super brief, because we have another bill after this one, and I want to be able to get through even your bill. So
yes, just absolutely. Good morning.
Members will want to ask questions.
My name is Erin Rafferty Buer, and I have been an art therapist in the community here in the Twin Cities for 26 years. And I have had the great privilege of working with various populations and finding incredible success. And just here to support everything that my colleague Brianna has mentioned, but just to, again, to continue to provide the point that we would like to ensure the required training is met to meet the ethical standards of practice for art therapy. And that's really what this clinical licensure art therapy bill would support, is the opportunity for us to understand and regulate those that are practicing art therapy as art therapists. So just wanted to emphasize that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And then we have one more, Jennifer Mollenhoff, and I would also ask you to be super brief if you can. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jennifer Mollenhoff. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Marriage and Family Therapy, and I'm here talking to you today on House File 2743 because the bill houses this new license were it to be created in the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy. The board did hear a presentation back in January of 2023 about this concept of licensure. There was no active bill in the legislature at that time, so the board took no formal action. It was an extended, engaged conversation, and I'm really just here to raise some of those questions that came out of that conversation so that the committee is aware of them as well. The first are the fiscal realities of the bill. We've referred to it a little bit already, but in Minnesota, health licensing receives no general fund dollars, so each licensing board must generate sufficient fees to cover the cost of operation. There is a fiscal note in the works on this bill. I've been working on it. I don't think it's yet completed. And overall, part of the difficulty is there's very little, if no data, to predict how many people would take advantage and obtain this license. So revenue projections are very difficult. It appears clear, at least from the information I have available, that funds from the existing marriage and family therapy license would have to subsidize a clinical art therapy license, at least for the foreseeable future. There'll certainly be more information in the fiscal note when it's made available. It's also unknown the extent to which this license creates new revenue and new licensees. Because it is possible now, if you complete a graduate art therapy degree, it is possible to become a licensed marriage and family therapist in Minnesota or a licensed professional clinical counselor in Minnesota. It's unclear whether creation of the license means more licensed professionals in Minnesota or if it just means we have LCATs, licensed clinical art therapists, instead of an LPCC or a marriage and family therapist. Again, just unknown based on the information available right now. Then there are the policy and practice realities of creating a license that does reference a specific type of modality of therapy, art therapy, and how that is interpreted and enforced for existing professionals who may already use art therapy. And should it become a new law, the question has arisen. I've already received the question about licensure for other specific modalities, dance therapists, music therapists, equine-assisted therapists. So just something to be thinking about and how licensure of those specific types of practices impact existing licensed professionals and how they use those skills in their current practice. And last, from the board discussions in January of 23 and the bill language, it appears clear that this LCAT license is envisioned by the proponents as becoming a mental health professional in Minnesota law, which is a term of art used throughout, you know, all of the statutes that address mental health. It's a little bit unclear in the bill, and then certainly if that is the intent, is to make an LCAT a mental health professional, there'd be significant other statutory changes, I think, that would have to make sure that that's the change, that that's effectuated throughout Minnesota law. So really just questions and some details that remained unclear to the board about effectuating this type of license. And I'm happy as the board representative, as is the board, to participate in those discussions and certainly to answer any questions you might have right now. Thank you.
So thank you for your testimony. So Ms. Mollenhoff, don't other states already license?
I think there, I don't know the exact number, 13, there are at least more than 10 other states that have a licensed clinical art therapy license, and then there are certain states that register them. The closest one in the Midwest of which I'm aware is Wisconsin. They register art therapists. It's not a license, but a registration. I'm sure I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but behavioral health licensure across the 50 states varies widely in terms of what they call their practitioners, how they license and regulate them. So I can't speak to another state that has the license, but yes, more than a dozen have this license.
Okay, well, we're going to lay the bill over. And so, Ms. Mollenhoff, we would really appreciate it if you could continue to work with the advocates and see if you can, you know, obviously we're going to have the fiscal note, but, you know, some of these questions, you know, I know this bill's been around for a while, and it seems like the issues involved are serious enough that that's why it's before the committee, and we need to find a pathway for some of the detriments that this
these practitioners have been experiencing. So if you could work with them and the board could work with them, that would be great, because we obviously want to have the board's support before we move forward with a new license. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Any other questions from members? All right. With that, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus. Thank you. Okay. We have done the HER bill, and we're on to House File 3494, Representative Bonner. All right, welcome to the committee, and Representative Bonner is a member of the committee. Is going to move that House File 3494 be laid over for possible inclusion, and I'll go ahead, Representative Bonner, and present your bill.
Thank you. I'll try to be as quick as possible here. Madam Chair and members, every day we turn around, we hear about mental health crises, or the mental health crisis, staff shortages, and challenges to critical care. This plays out across the state, but no more acutely than rural Minnesota. In 2019, the Minnesota Department of Health noted zero psychiatrists listed as practicing in rural areas of the state. While psychiatrists make up the most highly trained members of the mental health care continuum, physician assistants follow with about 2,000 hours of direct patient care before a program and about 2,000 additional hours as part of their clinical rotation, each playing a critical role in the care continuum. With critical shortage of psychiatric physicians and zero listed as practicing in rural areas, the role of PAs in this area becomes more essential in areas where care can be delayed by weeks or months. I think we can acknowledge waiting for vital mental health care may not be an option. Leaving these patients with no other options than to shift the burden to already overwhelmed emergency departments to fill the urgent need. There is a solution. Minnesota PAs are trained and licensed to diagnose mental health illness, prescribe medications, and monitor a patient's response to treatment. PAs consult and work in collaboration with psychiatric physicians as appropriate and refer to the cognitive behavioral therapist to provide talk therapy for more holistic patient care. These well-trained practitioners with thousands of hours of direct hands-on experience in accredited programs can fill critical gaps. Today, they provide 8.5 million patient visits, with 1.1 million of those in rural Minnesota. This has unfortunately led to a lack of access for rural patients, delayed care, higher dependence on expensive emergency care, a mismatch in which care settings are afraid to hire badly needed PAs due to administrative and legal confusion on their scope, and the ability to follow through on care in the best interest of the patient. Basically, House File 3494 is simple. It removes Subdivision 5 of the Physician Assistant Practice Act put in place in 2020, removing arbitrary limitations on PAs not consistent with all other 49 surrounding states. It maintains the current Section 3 PA practice agreement that clearly defines the PA scope of practice, renewed annually by a Minnesota licensed physician with knowledge of the PA's practice to ensure the PA is practicing within the scope, training, and experience. I want to note here today that the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice, who oversees physician assistants, voted unanimously in favor of the legislation. In a time of severe shortage, overburdened systems, and ever-growing mental health needs, we need to remove that confusion, well-intended. We need to allow nearly 4,000 PAs to act according to their training and licensure at a time when Minnesotans need it most. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifier.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bonner. My name is Elise Haupt. I am here today on behalf of the Minnesota Academy of PAs, or MAPPA. MAPPA represents the over 4,000 licensed by the Board of Medical Practice PAs here in Minnesota. I actually practice hospital medicine within the Health Partners system, and I work just down the street at Regents Hospital. So what we're asking for today is to strike the clause, the Subdivision 5 of the PA statute. This the language of this clause is confusing, redundant, and restrictive. Not just a restriction for PAs in psychiatry, it limits PAs in any setting from providing needed care for fear of violating this poorly defined restriction. It impedes healthcare organizations from utilizing PAs to their full extent for fear of violating the clause. And this clause does not add value or safety measures to PA practice or improve patient outcomes, but rather further obstructs access to much needed mental health care. As you already mentioned, Representative, we are in a critical shortage across the nation, but especially in rural Minnesota. And the American Academy of Family Practice notes that more than 87% of mental health care delivery is provided outside of psychiatry due to access challenges. PAs are indeed trained to provide care for patients with mental illness in all care settings, similar to our NP colleagues. PAs have an average, as mentioned, of 2,000 hours of direct patient care clinical education with specific curriculum and rotations in mental health care. This is double the training of our NP colleagues who do not have additional restrictions in their practice regulations. PAs are licensed by the Board of Medical Practice to diagnose physical and mental illness, prescribe treatment, and monitor response to treatments for patients with physical and mental illness. We currently provide mental health care across the spectrum of specialty settings, including primary care, emergency medicine, OBGYN, hospital medicine, and pediatric settings. We also practice in psychiatry clinics and psychiatric units. Subdivision 5 restricts PA practice in any and all areas of care and is not based on evidence of need regarding patient safety. There is, as mentioned, there is no other area of medicine that has such restrictions to PA practice, and indeed no other state that has PA practice restrictions like this. In addition to being far outside the norm from among state policy, this restriction is also in conflict with federal policy. Medicare includes PAs among the health professionals eligible to furnish outpatient diagnosis and treatments for mental health disorders. The National Rural Health Association and Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services identify PAs as key providers needed to alleviating mental health provider shortages. The federal 21st Century CARES Act defines PAs as, quote, high needed providers in mental health, end quote. The 2023 physician fee schedule rule specifies that behavioral health services provided by licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists can be provided under the general supervision of a PA, a physician, or other non-physician health professional. If the Board of Medical Practice and the federal government recognize that we are trained and qualified to provide mental health care across the healthcare spectrum and are part of the solution to the mental health crisis, why is this noble body, the Minnesota State Legislature, restricting us and limiting patient access? Before I close, I just want to comment there are some people who will testify shortly in opposition to this bill. They will argue again that they believe PAs are not adequately trained to provide mental health care under a practice agreement reviewed by a physician. However, they have no apparent concerns about our nurse practitioner colleagues practicing without physician oversight, though they have, on average, 2 semesters less coursework and half the required clinical training of a PA. I want to be clear. I am not critical of the training or care of my nurse practitioner colleagues. Our NP colleagues are well trained and provide excellent care for patients. My PA colleagues and I work with them every single day, and don't tell my other aunts, but my favorite aunt is a nurse practitioner. We have no concerns about how NPs serve Minnesota patients. So if you believe, as I do, that nurse practitioners provide excellent care based on their training, there should be absolutely no concerns about the care provided by a PA, as PA training exceeds the education and clinical training of an NP, and we practice in collaboration with physicians. It doesn't make sense, and the patients are the ones who suffer from these inequities as it restricts access. Again, thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing consideration of this bill. Thank you, Representative Bonner, for carrying it. We appreciate your efforts to assure Minnesotans receive the mental health care they need when they need it.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. We're going to go a few minutes over, members, so I hope that works for everybody. So thank you. Ms. Alderholden? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. NAMI Minnesota has serious concerns with this bill, as does Mental Health Minnesota. It will allow PAs to diagnose and treat children and adults with any type of mental illness. We, more than most, fully understand the need to increase access to mental health care and to build our workforce, but we also must take great care not to compromise on the quality of care. Our primary concern is actually allowing them to diagnose and treat people with serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, and other diagnoses that involve psychosis. I just want to actually ask you and think about how you would answer. If your son was hearing voices, would you go to a physician assistant? If your daughter was struggling with an eating disorder, would you go to a physician assistant? If you had experienced trauma, would you go to a physician assistant? Most likely, you would seek out some specialist. And although a lot of mental illnesses are treated in primary care clinics, many family physicians are rightfully cautious to diagnose and treat children or adults with these very serious mental illnesses. You may not be aware because, you know, these reports come to you all the time, and I just took two of the main pages, but the there was a report from the Department of Human Services to the legislature about using PAs in the mental health system. And what they said is that under current licensure requirements, they are underqualified by lack of clinical training and supervised experience to serve Minnesota's severely mentally ill MA population. Allowing coverage of mental health services delivered to vulnerable MA populations when provided by generalist physician assistants without advanced specialty mental health training would risk the safety of these individuals. They also went on to say that specialty training runs counter to tradition among PAs who view themselves and their field as generalists, capable of assisting a physician in any field of medicine, if so judged by the individual supervising physician. They go on to say that, you know, that this kind of runs counter to some of the complex mental illnesses we see. I do want to say that we have gone to the National Physician Assistant website where they actually recommend a number of things to help PAs actually qualify and specialize in mental health, including completing an additional clinical rotation in psychiatric health setting, completing a PA postgrad fellowship in psychiatry, and they actually list the type of inpatient units, completing a postgraduate fellowship in psychiatry in outpatient units, completing the NCCPA Psychiatry Certificate of Added Qualifications, and passing the NCCPA National Psychiatry Specialty Exam. The existence of these certifications shows that many PAs take mental health care seriously. We are very open to collaborating to increase access to care, especially in this time of crisis, but we hope that we can find a solution that allows PAs to practice safely and with the high-quality care we expect in Minnesota. But we really want to see these additional qualifications and trainings added when people are working with someone with a serious mental illness. The thing that you're getting rid of in this bill actually made sure that they could do the continuation of care for people with serious mental illnesses, but were not qualified to diagnose and develop that treatment plan. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? Okay, welcome. Okay, please state your name and go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, Bill Amberg, Amberg Law Office, representing the Minnesota Psychiatric Society. Dr. Trangle wasn't able to be here. Also, we have a letter forthcoming. Didn't quite get it done in time for this, but you should see it in the next day or so. And in the interest of time, our concerns are very similar to what Ms. Abderholden just testified to.
Okay, go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Amberg. So I guess my question, and then I'll go to Representative New Brindley, but my question is to Ms. Abderholden, I think, and that is the things that you're recommending or that you think that the PAs need more training, do the NPs have that? Like what's been explained to us is, you know, we have nurse practitioners who are, as has been discussed, working without any collaborative agreement. They can go out and set up their clinic somewhere and not and have no physician oversight, zero. And my understanding, am I wrong, is that they can do this. And do they have these additional certifications and training that you're discussing that you think that NPs need?
Madam Chair and members, there is a specialty certification that they can get in psychiatry, which we totally support. And I actually just talked to several hundred of them from the University of Minnesota just a few weeks ago. So they do actually have the ability to specialize. I will also say that we have had NPs come to us looking at changing the legislation so that they would be required to have more hours of supervision, actually recognizing, frankly, with humility, that perhaps they need more experience in diagnosing and treating serious mental illnesses.
So I understand your answer, Ms. Abderholden, to be that no, NPs don't have an additional requirement. You're saying maybe they could get it, but right now they can treat these patients, they can do this diagnosis with zero oversight from physicians and NPs who actually have more training can't. But let me go to Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps my questions are along the same lines a little bit. And I may have missed this in the testimony. There was a lot going on there very quickly, and I don't have the underlying language. So for PAs who would be allowed to do this, and generally I'm in favor of this, to be clear, for PAs to do this, what specific training do they have in dealing with mental illness, or would this apply to all PAs? Again, I don't have the underlying language here, so I don't know what the rest of it says.
Yeah, Ms. Say your name again.
Yep, Elise Haupt.
How?
The word how with a pt.
Haupt. Thank you. How?
Very German. Jawohl. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. So we have. So Ms. Abderholden is correct. We are trained as generalists, but we have twice the amount of clinical, hands-on clinical rotations as many of our NP colleagues, comparatively to many of our NP colleagues. And we have specific rotations in mental health. I myself had to do a rotation in mental health at my training facility. And what I'm asking for, what we're asking for, is the subdivision 5 be struck. Subdivision 3 remains, and that is our collaborative, our practice agreement with our physician. And that applies to all PAs where we have a practice agreement with a physician. And I want, so for example, I have a very wonderful colleague who practices bariatric surgery up north and near Duluth. Her collaborating physician is a bariatric surgeon. They are highly specialized. She was having a follow-up, this PA was having follow-up, a web-based telemedicine follow-up with a bariatric surgery patient. And they have a very strong therapeutic relationship. And this patient told my colleague, I'm having suicidal thoughts. I don't feel safe. I need... described that they were in crisis. My colleague, my bariatric surgery colleague, was messaging her MA as she was maintaining contact with the patient via telemedicine to get EMS, to get 911 out to that patient's house. She and her supervising, her collaborating physician are not psychiatrists, but they both recognize the standard of care is to recognize a patient is in crisis, whether it's a mental health crisis, whether it's a physical health crisis, diagnose it appropriately and get the care that they need appropriately. All PAs, all medical providers are still held to that standard of care. And we have an additional collaboration with our physician so that there is additional partnership there with another medical provider.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still a little bit unclear. So, and perhaps this shows my ignorance a little bit. Clearly we know that psychiatrists are medical doctors who specifically are trained to deal with mental illness and mental health. Mm-hmm. So if you've got an orthopedic surgeon, mm-hmm. are they able at any time to deal with mental health and to prescribe and deal with that in an ongoing way? Or is that limited to psychiatrists? I'm just trying to understand training and who can do what mm-hmm. right now.
So we can...
Ms. Haupt.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. I agree. An orthopedic surgeon goes through medical school, and then they specialize in orthopedic surgery. They learn all about the pathophysiology, and they have psychiatry rotations. Do they specifically treat ongoing mental illness? Probably not, but it is probably something. Mental health is pervasive throughout the spectrum of healthcare, right? And so they may. I don't want to conjecture here. I just to note that mental health is pervasive throughout the spectrum of healthcare. It is part of healthcare. They have basic training, and again, if they note that a patient's healthcare is impacting their physical health, they would appropriately refer that patient to where they need to go.
Yeah. So, Representative Brinley, I think it's a really great question. You know, this is confusing. I think you're right to sort of analogize the way physicians are trained. Because, yes, physicians are licensed. My husband, who's an internist, now retired, always tells me this. He's licensed to practice medicine and surgery in all its, you know, would he ever touch a surgery? No, it would be absolutely, but he is licensed to do that. Mm-hmm. But yet there's within that broad licensure, there is a scope.
Yeah.
And I think for PAs, it's a similar idea, if I'm not mistaken. Ms. Haupt can kind of, but the key issue here is that they are under this collaborative agreement.
Can I just ask one more question then? Please. As a follow-up. So would this scope, when we talk about this collaboration agreement, does this apply only to PAs who are in a collaborative agreement with a psychiatrist? Or does this apply, you know, I mean, would they be able to engage in ongoing psychiatric treatment if their collaboration agreement is with a bariatric surgeon or with someone who doesn't practice mental health?
Ms. Haupt?
Thank you for the question, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. So, no, the collaboration agreement, when we created this legislation in 2020, the collaboration agreement is focused at the practice site. So that PA and that surgeon or that physician are deciding what the scope of that PA is at that site. And if an issue is beyond scope, then the PA has to refer out, has to involve their collaborating physician. So I practice hospital medicine at a huge healthcare institution. We have very specific what we do in our delineation of privileges for each specialty. And again, mental health is pervasive throughout the spectrum of healthcare, but I know that I have psychiatric colleagues that I reach out to that when my collaborating physician and I realize this person needs more than what we can do, we collaborate. Same thing is with a primary care provider. They would do what they're able to do and have been trained to do and what the collaborative agreement is at that specific site. And when we are beyond what we are comfortable with, what our collaborative agreement, what our practice agreement outlines, we refer on. And the standard of care is is to refer on to get the patient the care that they need. That's the standard of care for any medical provider.
All right. We're going to have to kind of wrap it up here in about 5 minutes at the longest. So I've got Ryer and Nadeau, and then we'll lay the bill over. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is always about patient safety. I know that that's something we all have in common. And so my question is, either in the 49 states that allow this, or prior to when we had Subdivision 5 added in 2020, had there been problems in Minnesota that Subdivision 5 was a reaction to, or are we seeing problems in other states, not anecdotal, but from a pattern of data perspective? Thank you.
Ms. Haupt?
Thank you for that question, Madam Chair, Representative, that we have no data to show. There is no we are, not only do we have a collaborative agreement, but we are also licensed by the Board of Medical Practice. So we are overseen state from a state perspective by physicians. No one has brought any data forth. There is no evidence that there is huge, egregious patient safety issues.
Okay. Representative Breyer? Okay. And Representative Doe took his name off the list. And I would just say, kind of in answer to Ms. Abderholden, who said, you know, would you take your child for if they had this? And then I'll tell you what would happen in my case. I would take my child to Mayo Clinic, and I would go, and if I went to the psychiatric, they probably would have me see a PA. That is what would happen, and I would be very actually happy with that care. So that's my personal situation, and I think that's probably how it would happen in a lot of settings. So anyway, with that, thank you very much. Thank you to everyone who testified. We're going to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And with that, so as we know that this coming Tuesday, we do not have a hearing in here, and we will set the agenda for Thursday as soon as we are able. And thank you, everyone. We stand adjourned.